people all over the land are preparing for the king's coronation, and the king himself is rubbing his chubby little fingers with glee. I'm here to tell you, as a former British soldier, why the king must fall. Of all the institutions in this land, this is the one which we should be most critical of. These are gangsters, they're the Peaky Blinders, they're the Sopranos, they're the most vicious of the vicious, and that's how they found their way into power. And all the bunting and all the quiches and all the coronation chicken in the world cannot obscure that. They are the biggest gangsters of them all. £100 million for the coronation of a man who is unpopular even before he became king. At the same time, people who work on the trains, teachers, doctors, nurses, having to fight for a pittance, for a tiny pay rise, just so they can afford their rent and don't have to go to a food bank. The argument's bizarre to me because people say the royals bring in money, the royals bring in money. It's not that the royals are kind of in a glass case in Buckingham Palace and you can just wander around and feed them. I can't on camera advocate for us to use the French model, because I'd get in lots of trouble. But we could probably, you know, put them in a council house or something, tell them to get a proper job, tell them to start working for a living. There's absolutely a correlation between the French getting rid of the royal family and just having better lives, living longer. They have great hair, they have incredible food, they drive really fast, they're really sexy, they look really cool, drinking tiny coffees and chain smoking and whispering in French. And look at us, we're just this bunch of bumbling peasants who are still sucking up to this family of inbred morons. There is an argument put by people who are apologists for this thuggish clan who squat above us, taking all our money and land, who say that the Windsors are a sign, an emblem of order and of continuity. And they're not wrong, but not in the way that they think. What they represent is a continuity of inequality, of poverty, of unfairness, of unaccountable power, who pays no tax. But at the same time, they're always framed in terms of service, like they actually do anything except turn up for public events and cut ribbons. Not in terms of what they take, which is vast. They claw out of society with their grubby fat fingers, Charles. That is the real face of royal leadership, that they're just grimy tax dodgers at the end of the day, just like all these other big businesses and institutions. As a former soldier and the nation's favourite disgrace to Queen and country, a traitor to the crown, it's always interested me, this relationship between the army and the monarchy. In my book, I talked about waltzing, people who pretend to be soldiers, who wear medals they're not entitled to wear uniforms they're not entitled to wear. Those people get a lot of ire from the veterans community, and correctly so, arguably. But there are no bigger Walter Mitties than the royal family, who are the heads of various regiments and rock up in their uniforms, chat shit to the squaddies, like they're getting in touch with the common man, never having served in those regiments for the most part. And it's this kind of advanced case of military cosplay. It's always kind of bothered me that these people who are the heads of regiments and the heads of the military itself are basically a bunch of kind of LARPers. One of the royal family's many jobs is kind of as the marketing wing for various arms firms, for your BAEs and your Lockheeds and your Raytheons. And you see them cutting around, sometimes in military uniform, sometimes in local dress, this weird hedonistic cosplay. Don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but they're really into like going around, hanging out with dictators, putting on like Arab headscarves and Arab dress, for example, snuggling up to these people. But underpinning that, they're trying to flog weapons, flog missiles, flog all kinds of arms equipment to these countries. And that has long been their role. That's the case for Charles. It's also the case for Andrew. The true nature of monarchy is kind of concealed in a way which in those countries it isn't. It's raw power and absolutely dictatorial. Whereas in Britain, we have this kind of veil, this idea of a constitutional monarchy with some limits, and they can't do the things that they would perhaps they used to be able to do, or perhaps would want to, because we know some of these people are pretty unhinged. But it's interesting when you look at the parallels. Our green-fingered, well-branded king is actually best pals with some of the most brutal, authoritarian, tyrannical monarchs in the world. There is a proud culture of dissent against monarchy in culture, in our culture. And a good example of that is Monty Python railing against the idea of monarchy. The Sex Pistols, who did a particular great song about the Queen. I think it's waned, and I think that's sad. And I do wonder if it's because so much of culture, so much of music, so much of the arts has become an increasingly middle and upper class field. And it's much nearer to power. A lot of that anti-monarchist stuff, particularly with the Sex Pistols, came from an angry, bottom-up working class, a place of dissent and outrage. And there's an urge to mock power, which I think is one of the really redeeming things about the British, that we do and always have to some degree mocked power. We've lampooned kings, we've taken the piss out of queens. There's a long tradition of that, but I feel it's probably receded. Where are the artists who will mock power, challenging the common sense of society? God save the queen! The fascist regime! Not all kings King Charleses have had an easy run in this country. One was beheaded in the wake of the English Civil War. Two armies, the Army of Parliament, the New Model Army, and the army which supported King Charles, duked it out very bloodily in the 1600s. One of the end results of that was that we had what was called at the time the first 2 years of freedom. The Levellers were a radical movement, a diverse and radical movement. They literally wanted to level society. They wanted to make things more equal. And they cross-pollinated with radicals in the ranks of the New Model Army. The New Model Army was a fascinating beast. It unionised itself, and the various regiments started to elect agitators or agents who were kind of like trade union reps. The arguments those two organisations put, the agitators and the levellers, when they cross-pollinated, were fascinatingly sophisticated arguments about really fundamental things. Colonel Rainsborough, one of my heroes, who in the Putney debates clashed with Cromwell, Rainsborough said, "The poorest he in England hath a life to live as the greatest he." And it was an argument for the vote. In the end, the king was executed and Cromwell rose to power and became, in his own sense, a tyrant and crushed by force the democratic forces within the New Model Army. But nevertheless, the legacy, the spirit of those people endures. And there's probably a reason that that stuff isn't taught in schools. We learn about Henry VIII. We learn about how we were the good guys in the First and Second World War in a very unnuanced and uncomplicated way. But I think that history is particularly important because every serious country talks about their revolution. If you go to France, all they talk about is their revolution, liberty and fraternity and so on. The Americans will never shut up about their revolution, equality between men and so on and so on. However loosely applied they were at the time, the underpinning values are correct, I think. And we don't talk about our revolution here. But our revolution was the first revolution of that kind. It's a vital bit of a rich and interesting part of our history. And the centerpiece of that history is the idea of a republic and of a higher degree of equality than was available at that time. These are big questions which mattered then, and people spoke about them then, and they matter now, and we should speak about them now. If you look at the examples of history, why would you want to be a kind of meek and submissive peasant when you can be a raucous, roguish highwayman figure, or rather than this kind of meek tugging of the forelock, stout, cretinous yeoman? I think it speaks to a lack of political imagination and probably a lack of political understanding of what the monarchy is. They own vast amounts of beautiful countryside that we should all be allowed to walk around on. It's ours. It's ours by right, and it goes back a long way. The idea that you would steal from the rich and give to the poor has value. Is it really theft if you're taking it back from thieves? The greatest thieves of all are the gangster family of Britain, the Windsor Mafia. I have great faith in the democratic impulses and the egalitarian impulses of the younger generation coming through. And polls do seem to suggest that a lot of people, A, don't really care about the coronation, and particularly that young people would like to see an elected head of state. And I think that is something to be encouraged. Even monarchists, when they really ask themselves, they may gush about it and laud it and talk about stability and order, but I think inside everyone, anyone with any critical facility can look at that institution and go, there is something fundamentally wrong there. And we have in this country a long, proud, volatile, rich history of republicanism, of anti-monarchism. And we need, next time we get rid of them, not to keep it at 2 years, but make it a permanent affair. You saw the press coverage around the Queen's funeral. You can imagine what it's going to be like around the King's coronation. More than ever, it's important that there is an independent media that is not afraid to call out the monarchy. Support Double Down News on Patreon.